This is your tech news briefing for Monday, September 14th. I'm Amanda Llewellyn for The Wall Street Journal. Who is Sundar Pichai? The CEO of Google parent Alphabet commands one of the biggest companies in the world, and yet rarely finds himself in the spotlight. Today, our reporter Rob Copeland will help us take a look at Pichai and what his past can tell us about Google's future. That's coming up after these headlines. Oracle has won the bidding war for the U.S. operations of TikTok, according to a person familiar with the matter. Oracle is set to be announced as the social media app's, quote, trusted tech partner in the U.S., and the deal probably will not be structured as an outright sale, the person said. The move comes as TikTok has been caught in the middle of a geopolitical standoff. Both China and the U.S. have been ratcheting up restrictions that have put any chance of a deal in question. And our reporter Georgia Wells says it's not clear whether the arrangement will satisfy either country's demands.
We don't know yet if this will satisfy the U.S. regulators' concerns. Their questions have been about the security of the data for users, and the parties involved in the deal believe that this setup should satisfy the concerns of U.S. regulators. Now, on the other side, China has also had their own concerns about selling critical technology to the U.S., and our understanding is that at this point, really, the ball's more in the court of U.S. regulators.
And SoftBank is nearing a deal to sell Arm Holdings to NVIDIA for more than $40 billion. That's according to people familiar with the matter. Arm designs the microprocessors that power most of the world's smartphones. And NVIDIA is a growing industry player. Its chips are used to run calculations for graphics. So it plays a big role in things like video gaming and cloud computing. We've been reporting on deal talks for several weeks, and an agreement could be finalized as early as this week. If it does come together, it would be one of the biggest acquisitions so far this year, and potentially the largest semiconductor deal ever. Up next, we take a deep dive into Alphabet CEO Sundar Pichai. That's coming up after the break. Google and its parent company Alphabet are on the precipice of several major challenges. Regulators are expected to file antitrust lawsuits as early as this month. Another example, some say the company isn't as innovative as it used to be. As CEO of Alphabet, Sundar Pichai will play a key role in how the company navigates the headwinds. And while Pichai is not nearly as in the spotlight as the other tech leaders, he's already had a long history at Google. And by taking a look back, we can try and get some clues about how he might move the company forward. Our reporter Rob Copeland joins us with an inside look. Rob, thanks for joining me.
Thank you.
So at the tech hearing before the House Antitrust Subcommittee earlier this year, Pichai introduced himself as an immigrant, sort of the picture of the American dream. I wonder if you could start by telling us more about Pichai's upbringing.
Sure. So Sundar Pichai is definitely an outlier in many ways in Silicon Valley. Perhaps the most famous way that he stands out is that he was born in India. So he grew up middle class for India, but not necessarily at Western standards. He famously talks about growing up and getting his first rotary phone. He isn't such an older guy that the technology was just a lot less developed there. So he speaks frequently about the connection that he feels to technology and the knowledge that new technology can really change someone's life.
So Pichai eventually came to the U.S. for grad school. How did he find his way to Google?
He worked relatively ordinary corporate jobs until he joined Google right after its IPO. Google was not the Google that it is today. It really was just a search engine. He quickly impresses people for his ability to, one, build consensus, which is true to this day, but also sort of get the job done. His first major job at Google was on this toolbar product. So before there was Chrome, there actually was an add-on on your browser to search on Google. So his job was to convince companies like Dell, when they sold you a laptop, to have an automatic Google search bar on there.
So he's moved through the ranks since then, becoming CEO of Google and then last year taking over as Alphabet CEO. How did he make his way up the ladder?
Well, what's so remarkable is he's been at Google for 16 years, and we, even though we're the Wall Street Journal, have never done a full profile of him. So a big part of my task for the last few months was really unpacking who he is and how he got to this position. And what really emerges is that Google was a place, and still is a place, with big personalities. People who scream at each other, people who say we should bet the farm on this or that. And what Sundar sort of did was stay in the background, but he was also very careful that whatever he did, it worked. Starting with Toolbar, but that extends to Chrome, the browser, which he co-led and is now by far the most used web browser. One of the big reveals of this reporting for me was that he's a very strategic person. It's not an accident that he stayed in the background. For instance, someone who used to report to him told me early on in a meeting with Larry Page, who was CEO of Google before Sundar, Sundar made sure that they never disagreed in front of Larry. He really didn't want anyone to see any cracks. And this also emerges in a lot of the people I spoke to, some of whom Sundar himself suggested that I speak to. But then when I got on the phone with them, they didn't seem to know him too personally well. So he keeps it very close to the vest.
So it sounds like he's pretty deft at navigating sort of the company politics. Now that he's in the top spot, what's he known for as a leader?
So to a man, to a woman, everyone I spoke to said that Sundar has a tendency in the middle of meetings to stand up and begin pacing in the middle of your presentation. He won't say anything. It's not necessarily a sign that he likes or doesn't like it. It's just a sign that he's thinking. So you can imagine people have spent weeks preparing for the CEO and he leaps up in the middle and just starts pacing. It can be quite disarming, frankly. This comes back to the criticism of Sundar too. Standing up in the middle of meeting and pacing as you think is not necessarily your traditional, hey, drive the car forward leadership. If there's a big knock at Google today, it's that, and this comes from investors, analysts, even some executives of the company, it's that the company is pretty much operating on autopilot. It makes almost all of its money from online advertising, and you don't really have to do much besides sit there and the money comes in. You know, adding an extra ad to YouTube isn't exactly a high-level strategic decision. So the criticism is that Sundar hasn't necessarily made the big move to position Google for the next decade. On the other hand, when you have such a head start that Google has, just not messing up is a billion-dollar proposition.
And what about as a coworker? What's he known for on that front?
The best thing that Sundar has going for him is that people genuinely like him. In fact, one of his deputies, Cesar Sengupta, told me he loved Sundar Pichai. He said, the reason I've stayed at Google this long is because of Sundar. He's someone that I trust. He moved to Jakarta because Sundar asked him to. People say, in this whole world where everyone is obsessed with Silicon Valley, with what is happening in Menlo Park and Palo Alto and San Francisco, that Sundar has a truly global outlook, that he cares, for instance, about Google Pay in India, where there are many multiples number of people using payment products than there are in the US, but hasn't necessarily had as much investment. And one of the really fun things that is in the story is he's a very much a creature of habit. You can imagine you're CEO of Alphabet, you're traveling the world. Whenever he's in Korea, he goes to the same burrito place and orders the same veggie burrito. And in this world of these hard-driving CEOs who appear on TMZ or go through high-profile divorces, everyone says that Sundar Pichai is legitimately just a kind, nice guy.
So switching gears a little bit, if we look to the future, there are a lot of challenges on the horizon for Google and Alphabet. Given what we know about Pichai, how might we expect him to steer the company through those challenges?
There's no company in Silicon Valley that has more pressures right now than Google. There are attorneys general from almost every state, and the federal prosecutors are looking into filing antitrust charges. This mostly focuses on Google's ad business. And interestingly, Sundar, until becoming CEO of Google, didn't have much to do with the ads. He was really more focused on the products. And the products at Google aren't what anyone necessarily thinks they're dominant at. Now, what we've seen, for instance, in his testimony recently in Washington is that he's very, very tight. He doesn't like to answer the question. So he's going to have to make a decision whether he's willing to spin off some of this company. And it's really anyone's guess what he says.
And you mentioned that the company has also been accused of a sort of innovation stasis. What about on that front?
Exactly. And we should say Pichai chose not to speak with me for the story, which is his right. I spoke to a lot of people at the company and I said, where does Sundar see the future? And all of them said he sees it in AI, in artificial intelligence. The problem with that outlook is that basically every company, large and small, in Silicon Valley sees the future in AI. That's not necessarily a differentiated outlook. Now, Google has more money than almost anyone on Earth, and they certainly can afford to hire as many smart thinkers as possible. But at some point, you do need a person at the top to say, hey, we're headed here, and simply saying, let's use more artificial intelligence, that's not it.
All right, our reporter, Rob Copeland. Rob, thanks so much for your reporting.
Thank you.
Before we go, we're living in a unique moment in history. And while we're all figuring out how to navigate the current moment, the Wall Street Journal is also thinking about what comes next. That's why we've been putting on a virtual live event series where we talk to experts about the big changes coming to the ways that we live, work, and play. It's called the Future of Everything series. Last week, we held our Future of Social Media event. One of our guests was Andrew Frame, the founder of the public safety app Citizen. Citizen aggregates public information and users' eyewitness reports to provide real-time updates about crime and other safety incidents. But in the pandemic, Citizen made a quick pivot, and they added contact tracing to the app, too. Here's what Frame told us about how it works.
Well, if you have a safety app, you would expect it to keep you safe from all matters. And initially, we didn't understand how we might be able to play a role in the pandemic, even though it's clearly a safety issue. And then we figured out, well, if we take our 30% network of New Yorkers and we have them opt into Bluetooth, which is a 10-foot radius, the same as a contagious disease, and now if the Bluetooths see each other, it can keep track anonymously. So if somebody later tests positive, all of the other Bluetooth spheres, if you will be immediately notified anonymously, not exposing any identity, but just saying, hey, you may have come in contact with COVID-19.
We have lots more events coming up in the Future of Everything series. You can check it out and register at futureof.wsj.com. Okay, that's it for today's Tech News Briefing. I'm your host, Amanda Llewellyn. Thanks for listening.